Hi, I'm Stacy. I'm an adult child. Thank you for having me, and it's so good to see you guys. I miss you. We'll be coming back from Colorado on Halloween, and I hear we're going to have a special meeting on Halloween, so we should be back in time for me to check in on that. This is only the second time I've told my ACA story, and the first time I told it, it was at a conference, and it was AANA, Al-Anon, and ACA. So I really focused a lot on what ACA was, more so than my story. So I'll just get started. I'll go chronologically. And we are going to have question and answer. So if I start a story and don't finish it, which is kind of my way of going sometimes, so you just ask away. I was born in El Paso, Texas, and honesty was not one of the values of my family. I was told from the time I could talk that I was born 2 months premature because I was born 7 months after my parents got married. And I weighed 8 pounds, 6 ounces. And so by the time I was in fifth grade, I kind of figured this out. But I would ask and they would, oh, no, you were premature, and you know, whatever. My mother was 19 and my father was 23. And my father was an alcoholic and my mother has a mental disorder. And I think from an early age, I knew I needed to take care of myself. And we lived in a apartment complex with a pool in the middle. And so we all knew our neighbors. It was kind of like Melrose Place, if you guys remember that show. And our next door neighbor was kind of my babysitter. Her name was Eva. And she was kind of like a grandmother to me. And we were very close, and she would feed me and she would make sure I was dressed and made sure that I survived the party from the night before at my parents' house. And apparently she didn't like the way my parents were raising me. So my parents took her out of my life. And I found this out from my grandmother, who I was very close to. I called her Dear Heart, and she was an angel in my life. And so when I would tell her what was happening in our house, she would cry with me and she would listen to the stories. But she explained to me that she couldn't do anything because of what had happened with Ava. And so I, after a while, I quit telling her what was happening. And basically, my mother and I just butted heads from the beginning. And my father was, you know, an alcoholic, so he was drunk or he wasn't home. And there were constant parties at our house, people coming and going. And then when I was 4, my mom had my brother. And that was the beginning of me becoming overly responsible. I knew right away I needed to take care of him. I knew I just knew it was my job to take care of him. And my mom would go and hide in her room for hours. And this was back in the day when they used to heat baby bottles on the stove. And I remember being 4 and the kitchen was on fire. And I'm frantically screaming for my mother to, you know, come out. The kitchen's on fire. And she finally came out. She got the fire out. And then she started screaming at me because somehow it was my fault. I don't know how exactly. But that was, like I said, the beginning of me being overly responsible. And my brother really was my child in my mind. And that relationship stayed that way well into our adult lives. And, you know, my mother was involved with the Miss Texas Beauty pageant, and she would chaperone the girls and take them to all these places. And she would be so nice and so kind and so loving. And the girls would tell me, oh, you're so lucky you have such a wonderful mom. And And the message I got from that was, well, if I was as pretty as these girls, then my mom would be nice to me as well. And my parents were gone a lot, which was great, because then it was just me taking care of my brother, and we could have a lot of fun. And we did. We had a lot of fun together. And from the outside, everything looked really good. We had this beautiful house. We had a swimming pool. We had a live-in maid, you know, all these things. But, you know, when they would come home and being in these drunk craziness and the fights would start and things would start flying around the house. And I just felt like I had to protect my brother. And my dad was just checked out. You know, he just wasn't aware of what was going on because of his alcoholism. And I'd have crazy things happen at night. If I went to sleep before they got home, sometimes my mom would just come in my room and, you know, I know a lot of you've heard the story. She'd drag me out of bed and drag me to the kitchen and stuff my face in the sink and say I didn't rinse the sponge out right and it was stinking. And then another night she came in there and was, I can't even remember what she was upset about, but I had this giant aquarium next to my bed. And I jumped out of bed and she starts screaming at me and I screaming back at her, what's wrong with you? And she just took the whole thing and just crashed it into my bed. Mm-hmm. And what that did for me, that created a post-traumatic stress disorder. And whenever I am disturbed by anything at night, I, you know, that's where I go. I'm like shaking and, you know, I couldn't make any sense out of this because I was living in crazy. And once I became a teenager, and I remember one time we went out and we were at a pizza place and I was with my mom and my brother and my dad was gone as usual. And she bought a carafe of wine and I drank almost all of it. And I remember thinking, oh, thank God, this is how you deal with life. And from then on, I started drinking a lot. I drank every weekend. A friend of mine just recently told me that we used to drink before school. I don't even remember that, but that was how I started dealing with high school. And once I started drinking, I started becoming, you know, my false self really grew. I had this like, oh, I'm badass. I'm badass. I got this. I can take care of myself. And the last time my mother slapped me across the face, I was probably about 15. And we were about the same height at this point. And I remember she just slapped, you know, it was a normal thing for her. And my knee just reflexed back to kick her. And she jumped back. And that was the last time she laid a hand on me. And so I kind of got the message that I needed to be physical and loud and to protect myself. That was part of my false self that I developed. And then at this point, I got a boyfriend and he became my higher power. And I, you know, was completely enmeshed with him. And I did everything with him. We would ditch school. If you wanted to ditch school, I would ditch school. If you wanted to go over to Juarez, we would go to Juarez in the middle of the day, hang out at the racetrack. You know, this was all normal for me. And then I found out his father was in AA. That was the first time I'd heard about AA. And then one day I went over there and everybody was just like somebody had died. And they said that his father had relapsed in AA. And I got the message right away, oh, if you're an AA, you're not allowed to drink anymore. So, like, yikes, that's a bad place. I don't ever want to go. That was my first experience with AA. At this point, my senior year in high school, I found out that my mother was cheating on my dad with one of his friends. Mm-hmm. And I found this out at school from one of my friends. And my mother lied about the whole thing, and she left in the middle of my senior year. And my brother lost his mind. So apparently his relationship with my mom was different than my relationship. They had some sort of connection. And when I told him that what was going on, he started screaming at me and calling me a liar and had a fit. And I had a realization at that moment that it's not my duty to rip somebody out of their denial like that. It was kind of like my first sort of Al-Anon-ish type aha moment. And that kind of stuck with me through the years. And I felt immense guilt for causing him that kind of pain the way I did it. I was very callous in the way I did it. And I felt like a really bad mom because, like, he was my child. And my dad changed the locks on the house. And we were over at my grandmother's house. And my mom came over and was giving me the sob story of, "Oh, please just let me have the keys. I need to get my clothes. And your dad wouldn't let me have my clothes." And so I felt sorry for her, and I gave her the keys to the house. And when we got back to the house, me, my dad, and my brother walk in the front door, and I kid you not, everything was gone. Everything. The food had been taken out of the refrigerator, left on the counters. She took the washer dryer. Everything was gone. And my dad was like, "Oh my gosh, we've been robbed." And I was like, "No, Dad, I'm sorry. It was me. I gave mom." And he looks at me and he goes, "This is not your fault. This is your mother's fault." Mm-hmm. And he was very calm. My dad never said one unkind thing about my mom. And I wish I could say the same thing about my mom and about my dad. But so I really respect him for that. And I don't know what he did, but the next day everything was back. So, meanwhile, I'm in this relationship I've been in with my high school boyfriend. We've been in it for 4 years. I'm so bored. I can't stand it anymore. We're fighting constantly. I'm still in El Paso. I'm going to UTEP. And, I'm like, how am I going to get out of this relationship? I mean, I have no role models here on how you leave somebody other than you find a new person and you leave with them. And that's what I did. I met somebody while he was on vacation in Mexico. And when he came back, I had moved to Austin. I had never even been to Austin, but this new guy that I met wanted to move to Austin. So I moved with him. And it was, you know, I was off to the races as an alcoholic on my own in Austin. But I had enough Al-Anon in me to try to control things. And I realized that I couldn't drink and drug the way I was and graduate from college. So I would like plan my classes around my drinking, and I got through college somehow. And then I met who would turn out to be my first husband. And I married him because he asked me to. He happened to be the person I was dating when everybody was getting married. And he asked on a plane and everyone was watching, and I said yes. And honestly, in my heart, I was getting bored with that relationship too, because he did not drink the way that I drank. He didn't fight the way that I fought. I'm a fighter and he's a freeze. And I didn't understand that at the time. And, you know, I'd engage, because to me, that kind of excitement, that addiction to excitement, was love. That I mistook that for love. And so he didn't love me because he didn't know how to fight with me. And he wouldn't get emotionally intoxicated unless he was watching the Dallas Cowboys play. That was the only time I ever saw him get excited. So I divorced him and decided to find somebody who drank like I drank. And so then came husband number two. And I married him because he looked like George Clooney. And he drank the way that I drank. And he was in a band. And he sang really good, and he couldn't hold a job or make money or anything like that. So I supported him until he ran off with a stripper and I wanted to kill myself. And yes, I was very much addicted to excitement. And I thought I was drinking and drugging the way I was because of him. But when he left, my drinking and drugging took on a whole new level. I didn't draw sober breath the last 4 months of my drinking. Mm-hmm. And my brother was the one who said, his drinking and drugging was right up there with me. And we did a lot of partying together. And he called me one day and said, I need you to take me to treatment. So I was like, oh my God, what happened? He said, nothing. I'm just sick and tired of living like this. So I took him to treatment. I read the brochure, Are You an Alcoholic? While I was sitting there waiting. And there were 20 questions. I answered yes to all of them, except for the one that said, do you drink in the morning? Because I didn't think that mimosas and Bloody Marys at brunch counted as drinking in the morning. That was as honest as I knew how to be at the time. And so when he got out of treatment, we went to our first AA meeting. And I stayed and he went back out. And when he went back out, he went from smoking pot and drinking a 12-pack every day to crack and meth. And I really thought I was going to die. I mean, I was newly sober. My brother is, you know, completely out of control. And he went into treatment again a second time. And his counselor got in my face and said I needed to go to Al-Anon. And that every time I helped my brother, I was helping to kill him. And so at that time, I met a friend in AA, one of my litter mates. I think I had 4 months sober, and she was brand new. And I made her my new little sister. And I transferred all of my enmeshment and codependency that I had with my brother, and I put it onto her. Of course, I didn't know this at the time. And she had a similar background to mine, and I acted like I knew it all, you know, and I was going to fix her, and she needed me, and it gave me a purpose. And around that same time, I also met my husband, Mike, that a lot of you know, that I'm married to now. We've been married 15 years, and I just really didn't know how to have a relationship, though. So we started going to therapy. We started having these power struggles. And finally, my brother got sober. And thank you, God, he's got 9 years sober now. And we did an intervention on my dad. My dad got sober. My dad died with 14 years of sobriety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, life is looking good on the outside. Everything's going pretty well. And we're having a lot of success in life. And then we bought our place in Santa Barbara. And so I started going to, I felt like my program, there was something missing because I still didn't feel really comfortable in my own skin. And a lot of people were telling me you need Al-Anon. Al-Anon is what you need for your codependency. And so I was going to Al-Anon and in Santa Barbara. And I just had this feeling God was telling me that there was something missing. And, you know, my false self and trying to fit in a new environment. And there's this quote that I love that Bill Wilson, who started AA, says, many oldsters who have put our AA booze cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Peace and joy may still elude us. And that was about how I felt. I had 14 years of sobriety. I'd been in Al-Anon for like 10 years and there was still something missing. And I was at the Montecito yoga class and I was meeting my husband there. And he was saving me a spot next to him, and I walked in and he was kind of, the yoga teacher was kind of getting everybody organized or whatever. And the class was packed. There was tons of people in there. And all of a sudden, he just turns on me and says, get out, you're late. And I literally had like, I mean, I don't know. It was like a soul rupture. Like, I know you guys know what that feels like, where you're just like, the wind is knocked out of you. And so an Al-Anon meeting was about to start. So I went straight to it. And yeah, that was, you know, I got on my intellectual level that what happened was rude and uncalled for, but I was hysterical sobbing. I was having an extreme reaction to what had happened. And so I'm sharing this in this Al-Anon meeting. And I see now that it was all part of God's plan for me. And after that meeting, three different people came up to me and said, honey, you need ACA. I was like, what, you know, why I'm here, I'm in Al-Anon, what's the difference? And they were all three of them shook their head and they were like, it's not the same. And it was explained to me, I go to AA because I'm powerless over my alcoholism. I go to Al-Anon because I'm powerless over other people's alcoholism. And I go to ACA because I'm powerless over being raised in a dysfunctional home and the traits that I developed to survive in that. So I don't go to Home Depot to buy milk. There's no milk there. Each one of those 12-step programs has its purpose. It is not Al-Anon's purpose or AA's purpose to help me to heal from the effects I had growing up as a child in dysfunction. And I did not want to go. I was like, oh, hell no, not another 12-step program. So I thought about it. And then, again, God gives me another growth opportunity. I'm in my room. I'm reading. It's late. My husband's watching TV. And I'm reading. And here he comes in the bedroom. He flips the light on. And he starts talking loud. And I lost my shit. I went off on him. I was having a PTSD moment. I just started raging at him. And he was like looking at me like, what the hell is wrong with you? And then I felt intense shame and guilt. And I was like, what is wrong with me? You know, why am I like this? What is wrong with me? So I kind of took that as a hint to go ahead and go to this ACA meeting that we're all, you know, the Sunday night ACA meeting, I should say. Or not Sunday night, the Sunday 1:45 meeting at First Congregation. And I did not want to go. I went in there with a really bad attitude. Mm-hmm. They were reading, you know, the stuff at the beginning of the meeting, and they were talking about, this is a fragrance-free meeting. And I was like, what the hell? I mean, I'm sorry. I get it now that people have sensitivity to fragrance. But, you know, here I am. I'm coming from Texas, and I don't want to be here. And you guys are talking about fragrance-free. And I'm like, woo-woo, whatever. You know, I didn't want to hear it. And, but then I started listening, and I started, when the laundry list was read, I related to every single trait. I was like, okay, obviously I qualify. And at the time there was another woman in the meeting who had just started also. She had like 4 more months than I did. And she would share her story. And I was just sitting there like this going, you know, whatever. And I was really, I mean, I don't know what was wrong with me. I guess I was just resistant, because I'm not like that when I'm in an AA meeting. But I kept going back, but I wouldn't really talk to people. I wouldn't get numbers. And so I monitored the meeting for about 6 months. Well, then the shit hit the fan. And my dad was dying. And my husband got diagnosed with cancer and had to go through a stem cell transplant in Houston. And I have like 5 minutes of ACA sobriety. And so I decided that I was going to ask my therapist to be my sponsor. So I'm in Houston. I'm trying to do the workbook with my therapist. I'm going to ACA meetings in Houston. And I had a little breakthrough. And for some reason, my higher power told me to share this with my dad, some of this stuff with my dad. And so I did. And we had the most amazing, you know, I mean, just soul to soul conversations. And, you know, he had already made amends to me in AA. But I really told him the truth about what it was like growing up. And I told him how he had abandoned me. And I told him about the abuse with my mother. And he cried with me. And he said he didn't know. And he was so sorry. And I said, I feel bad telling you this stuff now. And he said, no, I'm glad you did. And so our last times together before he died at 74, which is young, I think is young. And it was all consequences from, you know, his disease of alcoholism. And he didn't get a chance to do ACA, but he definitely qualified. My grandfather was an alcoholic and my grandmother was an unrecovered Al-Anon. And he died of cardiovascular disease from drinking and smoking and drugging and all of that stuff, because he didn't get sober till he was 60. But so while my husband's going through stem cell transplant, my father has just died, and I'm using my therapist as an ACA sponsor because I'm not ready to trust you guys yet. And I start, you know, I was going to meetings, I was going to AA meetings, and I was going to ACA meetings. And when I would go to AA meetings, I got a lot of love, but everyone was asking me, how's Mike? How's Mike? How's Mike? How's Mike? And when I would go to ACA, everybody was like, how are you? How are you? And I needed that. I needed that to get through it. And I felt so alone. My best friend that I had invested all this time with, who I had been so inseparable with, when my dad died, I asked her to come over, and she said no. And so I went crying to my ACA therapist sponsor, and she just told me that I was being selfish, that I expected my best friend to be there for me because my dad died, and that she wasn't able to show up for me the way I wanted to, and that I was being selfish. And I mean, I really felt like my higher power was saying, whoa. So I went to an ACA meeting, and as God would have it, we were reading out of the Red Book, and we read a portion out of the Red Book that said that we tend to recreate critical parents in our lives. And then it listed a bunch of different ways we do that with bosses or whatever. And then I said, and therapists. And I realized that my therapist was the critical parent in my life, and that I spent a lot of my time with her critical voice in my head, repeating to me the critical things that my mom used to say to me. And it was a really dark night of the soul, because I really felt alone in the world. And My beloved grandmother was, you know, holding on. She was 97 years old, and she was like, I can't die right now. You've been through too much. And I was like, what are you going to do? Just hang on. She said, yeah, I'll know when it's time, but it's not time yet. And so I came back to Santa Barbara. Mike was doing great. He survived that. And the woman who... The woman who had 4 months before me at the meeting was like a different person. She talked about how she had worked the workbook with her sponsor, how her heart had been opened, how her life had changed with her husband, with her family, with her sister. And she had also just lost her father as well. And it was like, she was a different person from the person I had known before I left Santa Barbara. And I was like, I want what she has. Mm-hmm. And she's going to be my sponsor. And so I asked her, and she'd never been in 12-step before, and she had never sponsored anybody. And I said, you can do this. I go, I can tell you how to be a sponsor. I said, but you've got to tell me how to get through this workbook, because I want what you have. And she said, okay, well, we'll try it out. And she has saved my life. And in so many ways, her spirituality, her open heart, her lovingness, I felt like I had a rock, you know, in my life. And my grandmother died shortly after that. Mm-hmm. And I really, you know, the first meeting we had, and we went over step one, and, you know, I was coming from an offender-based program. You know, powerlessness in AA is very different, and Al-Anon is very different than powerlessness in ACA. Because I was telling her about all my guilt and shame for all of my reactions, for yelling at my husband when he came into the room and scared me, and all these things, all my triggers. And she just looked at me and she goes, "Stacy, don't you know that that is what powerlessness is?" She goes, "You are powerless over the fact that you have these triggers. And the only way to heal them is to relive them in, you know, through grief therapy," which is what we do here, not alone grief therapy. For me, that's self-pity and wallowing in self-pity, self-indulgent self-pity. But to do this grief processing together with somebody else so that these triggers don't have this heavy power over me. And I don't know. I had a spiritual moment at that time. And then when we did the fourth step and went through all those worksheets and all the shame busters, and it started to make sense why I had all this PTSD, why I had all these reactions. So now when I feel them, I have tools and I can soothe myself and I can talk to myself and I can remind myself that, you know, it's okay. It's not that time. You're okay. Yeah, that sucked. And that person was rude, or, you know, whatever the situation is, I have tools now. And I have developed a relationship with my mother. My relationship with my mother is, you know, it's not what I would probably have wanted, but it's workable. And I can see now that the woman who abused me isn't the old woman who's sitting in front of me now today. Mm-hmm. And I can forgive all of that and move on. And it's helped my relationship with my husband. I'm able to explain to him in a calm adult tone, when you come into the bedroom and flip the light on like that, it scares me. It reminds me of the times when my mom would do that to me. And hopefully I won't have another reaction like that. But if you could please try to understand and be sensitive to that, that would help me a lot. And I'm able to set boundaries now. And I wasn't able to do that before. I was too busy people pleasing. And one of the greatest gifts of recovery are my sponsees. And I love you guys so much. And it's such an honor to work with you and to help, you know, us all feel each other's pain together. And we help each other carry it. And it's just astounds me how God brings people together with similar soul wounds and soul ruptures. And I really feel like I do have a purpose now. I really feel like there's magic in that yellow workbook, you know, and there's magic in this program. And I'm just going to close here with this. Another quote from Bill Wilson, who I am forever grateful. He saved my life. Bill Wilson, who himself suffered deep childhood trauma, predicted in 1956 that a new fellowship would someday use the 12 steps and a caring community to heal long buried psychic damages. In ACA, much as Bill Wilson envisioned, we face our past together and stop reenacting what was done to us. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you, Stacy. So please join me, everybody, in thanking Stacy for sharing her story with us.
Thank you.
Awesome.